Joy 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Gregory Stockel, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
A large oil spill off the Southern California coast left fish dead, birds covered in oil, and wetlands polluted. The spill is one of the largest in the recent history of California. It is suspected to have been caused by an underwater pipeline. Kim Carr is the mayor of Huntington Beach, near where the spill took place. She said an estimated 573,000 liters of unprocessed crude oil leaked into the Pacific Ocean. Some appeared on the California coast, about 65 kilometers south of Los Angeles. Carr called the spill an environmental catastrophe. She added, "This oil spill constitutes one of the most devastating situations that our community has dealt with in many years." Officials said the popular beaches of Huntington and Laguna could be closed for weeks or months. Residents, business owners, and environmentalists have questioned whether officials reacted quickly enough to contain the spill. People who live and work in the area said they saw the shine on the water and the smell of oil Friday evening. But the U.S. Coast Guard did not announce that oil had been seen until Saturday afternoon. It said it was leading a cleanup operation. The company that operates the pipeline, believed to be responsible for the spill, shut it down on Saturday night. Rick Torgerson is the owner of Blue Star Yacht Charter, a company that operates boats in the area. He said on Friday evening, people were emailing and the neighbors were asking, "Do you smell that?" He said boats were returning with oil on them. Gary Brown is president of the environmental group Orange County Coast Keeper. Brown lives in Huntington Beach. He said, "By the time it comes to the beach, it's done tremendous damage." He felt officials could have avoided the damage if they had acted quickly. The leak appeared to come from a pipeline connecting to one of the three oil production structures off the coast of Huntington Beach. They are owned by Amplify Energy Corporation. Amplify head Martin Wilshire said the pipeline and the structures, called rigs, were shut down Saturday night. The company said it has removed the rest of the oil in the pipeline and is investigating where and why the spill happened. I'm Anna Mateo.
In the past years, Lee Reich, a well-known gardener, has planted several sorts of nuts, including hazelnuts. Hazelnuts come from the hazel tree. They are often eaten and ground into a mixture that can be spread. Hazelnuts are also known as filbert nuts, especially from the European sort. After planting the young trees, Reich found they produced their first nuts within 3 years. Sadly, the nuts could not be eaten. They were small and did not taste good. He did find the catkins, the male flowers, to be beautiful in the winter. And each autumn, the tree's leaves turned to bright colors. A few years after planting those trees, he planted more hazels. The newly planted trees were from a sort that was made to produce large, flavorful nuts. They come from the European hazel trees. They are found around the Mediterranean area of Europe or in the northwest of North America. They produce the nuts that are found in supermarkets. A disease called filbert blight is what has historically kept people from growing filberts in the eastern United States. Blight is a name for any plant disease. Filbert blight is native to North America and had little effect on hazel trees native to North America. However, it is very dangerous to the European ones. The blight causes a collapse and death of the branches. The disease can go years without being seen due to its long lifetime. It can be 10 years before a tree is killed. Cutting off infected branches or pruning and spraying chemicals are two ways to deal with blight. The disease found its way to commercially grown filbert trees in northwestern North America. This created the need to find sorts of hazels that are resistant. Two trees were identified early on, Hall's Giant and Willamette. Now, there are many that are resistant. Lee Reich plans to plant these resistant trees in his garden. I'm Gregory Stockel.
American scientists say they have created a vaccine patch that provides greater protection against infectious diseases than traditional injections. A 3D printer is used to make the patch, which is smaller than the tip of a finger. Each patch, which contains many small microneedles, can be put directly on the skin. The researchers said in a statement, the experiments showed the patch provided an immune response 10 times greater than vaccines injected into arm muscles. And they reported it offered an immune response 50 times greater than vaccines injected under the skin. The tests were carried out on mice, with plans to expand the experiments to humans. The results were recently described in a study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The team was led by scientists from Stanford University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The researchers say the increased effectiveness happens because the patch releases substances directly into the skin, which is full of immune cells that are targeted by vaccines. The scientists say that in addition to the patch vaccine being better at fighting disease, it has several other advantages over traditional injections. The patch is painless, does not require cold storage, and can be given by individuals themselves. The COVID-19 pandemic has demonstrated the importance of vaccines as a way to control viruses in massive populations. But there are barriers that prevent some populations from getting the injections. One of these is the need to keep the vaccines in cold storage. Another is that it can be difficult for people in many parts of the world to get to a place that can administer the shots. The researchers developing the patch say they hope the method will one day help solve these issues and increase vaccine access to millions more people around the world. And because of how the patch works, a smaller amount of vaccine can be used. Xiaomin Tian is a researcher in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the UNC School of Medicine. She helped lead the study. She said in a statement that the team was able to overcome manufacturing difficulties that have hurt efforts in the past to create an effective patch vaccine that uses microneedles. Tian said one problem with past methods was a reduction in needle sharpness from repeated manufacturing using patch molds. But the researchers' new method permitted them to directly 3D print the patches, which gives us lots of design latitude for making the best microneedles from a performance and cost point of view, Tian said. The team says it is continuing to work on developing ways to include current COVID-19 vaccines, such as those from Pfizer and Moderna, for use in microneedle patches for future testing. The method could be used for other disease vaccines as well. Other research has been done on the use of vaccine patches. Last year, scientists from the University of Pittsburgh announced they had developed a COVID-19 vaccine that could be delivered into the skin through a patch of 400 microneedles. And in Australia, researchers from the University of Queensland reported in June they had created a vaccine patch that demonstrated extremely clear results in tests on mice. The scientists said the patches produced much stronger and more protective immune responses against COVID-19 than traditional vaccine delivery methods. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1850, the northern and southern states threatened to split over the issue of slavery. At that time, owning slaves was legal in the southern states. Many northerners opposed slavery, and the question remained, should slavery be legal in new territories in the western part of the country? The two sides disagreed strongly, but the issue needed to be settled. So Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise. Conservative Southern lawmakers rejected it. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina especially spoke against the compromise, but other lawmakers supported it, including one of the nation's top political leaders. Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts said the compromise was the only way to save the Union of States. 4 days after Webster's speech, Senator William Seward of New York presented his ideas to the Senate and to the nation. Seward was a northerner. He said he opposed any compromise with the South. He said he did not want slavery in the new Western territories, and he called for a national policy to start peacefully ending slavery everywhere. Seward criticized Daniel Webster for speaking against abolition societies. He said such groups represented a moral movement that could not be stopped. He said the movement would continue until all the slaves in America were free. Seward then criticized John C. Calhoun. He denounced Calhoun's demands for a political balance between the North and South. He said this forced balance would change the United States from a united national democracy to an alliance of independent states. In such a system, he said, the minority would be able to veto actions of the majority. A few weeks after Seward spoke, John C. Calhoun died. One newspaper in Calhoun's home state said, "The senator's death is best for the country and his own honor. The slavery question will now be settled." Calhoun would have blocked a settlement. In fact, many lawmakers had come to support the idea of Senator Henry Clay's compromise, but they could not agree on which parts of it to pass first. Southern supporters were afraid that if a statehood bill for California was passed first, then Northerners would refuse to pass the other parts of the compromise. So Southerners wanted to include all parts in one bill. A committee of 13 men was named to write a bill based on Henry Clay's compromise. The committee had 6 members from slave states and 6 from free states. Senator Clay was named to lead it. 3 weeks later, the committee offered its bill. It was much like the compromise Clay had first proposed. It made California a free state. It created territorial governments for New Mexico and Utah. It settled the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. It ended the slave trade in the nation's capital, the District of Columbia, and it urged approval of a new law dealing with runaway slaves. For about a month, the bill seemed to have the support of President Zachary Taylor. But then the president made it clear that he would do everything he could to defeat it. Taylor did not think the nation was in crisis. He did not believe the dispute over slavery was as serious as others did. He had his own plan to settle one part of the dispute. He would make the new territory of California a free state. There, slavery would be banned. Taylor's plan did not, however, settle other parts of the dispute. It said nothing about laws on escaped slaves. It said nothing about slavery in the District of Columbia. It also said nothing about the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Senator Clay, who had offered the compromise, questioned President Taylor's limited proposal. Clay said, "Now, what is the plan of the president? Here are five problems, five wounds that are bleeding and threatening the life of the republic. What is the president's plan? Is it to heal all these wounds? No such thing. It is to heal one of the five and to leave the other four to bleed more than ever." While the debate continued in Washington, the situation in Texas and New Mexico got worse. Texas claimed a large part of New Mexico, including the capital, Santa Fe. Early in 1850, Texas sent a representative to Santa Fe to take control of the government. The United States military commander in New Mexico advised the people not to recognize the man. The governor of Texas was furious. He decided to send state soldiers to enforce Texas's claims in New Mexico. He said if trouble broke out, the United States government would be to blame. President Taylor rejected Texas's claims. He told his Secretary of War to send an order to the military commander in New Mexico. The commander was to use force to oppose any attempt by Texas to seize the territory. The Secretary of War said he would not send such an order. He believed that if fighting began, Southerners would hurry to the aid of Texas. And that, he thought, might be the start of a Southern struggle against the federal government. In a short time, the North and South would be at war. So the Secretary of War refused to sign the order. President Taylor answered sharply, "Then I will sign the order myself." Taylor had been a general before becoming president. He said he would take command of the army himself to enforce the law. And he said he was willing to hang anyone who rebelled against the Union. President Taylor began writing a message to Congress on the situation. He never finished it. On July 4, 1850, Taylor attended an outdoor Independence Day ceremony. The event was held on the grounds where a monument to America's first president, George Washington, was being built. The day was very hot, and Taylor stood for a long time in the burning sun. That night, he became sick with pains in his stomach. Doctors were called to the White House, but none of their treatments worked. 5 days later, President Zachary Taylor died. His vice president, Millard Fillmore, was sworn in as president. Millard Fillmore was from New York State. His family was poor. His early education came not from school teachers, but from whatever books he could find. Later, Fillmore was able to study law. He became a successful lawyer. He also served in the United States Congress for 8 years. The Whig Party chose him as its candidate for vice president in the election of 1848. He served in the office for about a year and a half before the death of President Taylor. Fillmore had disagreed with Taylor over the Congressional Compromise on Slavery and the Western Territories. Unlike Taylor, Fillmore truly believed that the nation was facing a crisis, and he truly believed the compromise would help save the Union. Now, as president, Fillmore offered his complete support to the compromise bill. Its chances of passing looked better than ever. Fillmore asked the old cabinet to resign. He named his own cabinet members. All were strong supporters of the Union. All supported the compromise. Congress debated the compromise bill throughout the summer of 1850. The bill included several proposals. Supporters decided not to vote on the proposals as one piece of legislation. They saw a better chance of success by trying to pass each proposal separately. Their idea worked. By the end of September, both the Senate and House of Representatives had approved all parts of the 1850 Compromise. President Fillmore signed them into law. One part of the compromise permitted California to enter the Union as a free state. One established territorial governments in New Mexico and Utah. One settled the dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Another ended the slave trade in the District of Columbia. Many happy celebrations took place when Americans heard that President Fillmore had signed the 1850 Compromise. Many people believed the problem of slavery had been solved. They believed the Union had been saved. Others, however, believed the problem only had been postponed. They hoped the delay would give reasonable people of the North and South time to find a permanent answer to the issue of slavery. Time was running out. It was true that the 1850 Compromise had ended a national crisis, but both Northern and Southern extremists remained bitter. Those opposed to slavery believed the compromise law on runaway slaves violated the Constitution. The issue of slavery was linked to the issue of secession. Did states have the right to leave the Union? If Southern states rejected all compromises on slavery, did they have the right to secede? The signing of the 1850 Compromise cooled the debate for a time, but disagreement on the issues was deep. It would continue to build over the next 10 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.